Good evening and welcome to the Chase Lounge. I'm your host, Chandra B. And as a therapist, I have been helping couples find their way back to love and each other for over 20 years. Join me and learn new ways to create, build, and renew the communication, connection, and commitment in your love life. Change starts with you, so come in and join the conversation. Good evening and welcome to the Chase Lounge. I'm your host, Chandra B. And today I have a very special guest with me, someone that I met during a time when we were on someone else's show. And he's an author, a father, and it sounds like you're a teacher or something like that too, a pastor. You got many hats, huh?
All that. Yeah, I'm also an educator, and I'm also one of the co-pastors in my church.
Okay. So, he had an interesting perspective, and also when we were talking about relationships, but also you're a conflict management professional, right? Like, aren't you getting your PhD or something like that?
Yes, I'm currently getting my PhD in conflict resolution. So I'm okay. ABD at the moment, all but dissertation.
Okay.
I'm about halfway through my dissertation.
Awesome. So that's what I know about you, but you can tell us about you, your book, and where they can find you and reach out to you if you like.
Yeah, absolutely. Thank you for having me on your platform. I appreciate it. These opportunities to be able to share with people about my new book that's out titled Let's Get Married and Do Everything Except That Make It Last, A Heart-to-Heart with Men on Loving and Leading. And it's a book about love, marriage, and relationships. And it takes a very staunch look at the social norms of gender roles and how all of those things intersect into the conflicts that we're seeing in our society today. And the book offers some solutions as well. I'm also, like I mentioned, a doctoral student finishing up my PhD in conflict resolution studies. And I've been doing leadership development and conflict resolution training for 20 years now.
Okay. For 20 years.
And by training,
years.
I mean, yeah. Meaning internationally, I've worked with corporations, done corporate training, worked with individuals. I'm also a life and relationship building coach, which those things overlap as well when we talk about leadership development and conflict resolution at an interpersonal level.
So tell me a little bit more about the book in terms of how that... You know, what the title in and of itself, let's do everything, let's get married and do everything but stay together. What is that about?
Well, so it's really a double entendre. And when you look at the way the title was written, it gives you an opportunity to make a choice, right? So it's let's get married and do everything except make it last. But the way the title is set up, it's you can get married and make it last.
Right.
Or you can do everything except make it last.
Right.
And secondly, the subtitle is A Heart to Heart with Men on Loving and Leading. And the book speaks to that. What does leadership mean? What does it mean for a man to love? And it takes a very deep look at how I think we're ultimately set up for failure. Right.
Okay.
So it's as if we've said, let's get married and do everything except make it last.
Right.
By way of how we are socialized and normalized into what a relationship is supposed to be.
And I agree with you. I think that one of the things that I find in relationships and one of the things that I talk about a lot on this show is that we build our house upside down. You know what I'm saying? We don't even talk about our values, what's important to us. We just enjoy having, you know, spending time together, doing the fun stuff. And then when it gets serious, we realize we really don't have that much in common, or how you see things and how you want to do things is not the way that I want to do them. And then Right. That's when the conflict arises. So it's like, we don't get to know each other before we say, I do. You know, we know each other, but we don't know the values, the core values, the things that matter most to each other. And we say, I do. And then it doesn't last. 50%.
I definitely understand what you're saying. I think in addition to that, not only do we not know our core values, I don't think I don't think our core values are highlighted to be as important as they actually are. So much of what we talk about, put emphasis on, deals with people finding financial security. We live in a capitalistic society. We live in this Judeo-Christian society, along with other religions that still has a lot of patriarchal values with it, coupled with capitalism. That makes for a very daunting situation when we talk about relationships, because the enterprise of relationship becomes fundamentally business oriented. Mm-hmm. And it's mm-hmm. more about what you can do for me and how you can provide security for me than it really is about those other intrinsic values that we learn later are much more important than what they than the emphasis that was put on them in the beginning.
Right, right. But so I'm hearing you, but you correct me if I'm wrong. Who is it more daunting for? You know, because again, you really, it sounds like your book is talking to men, like helping them to understand their role in making this last.
But the book is also for women.
Oh, no, I agree. It's for women. Yeah. You know, I think that it is definitely for women, but I'm saying it's when we think about it from, you know, Judeo-Christian or just from even a patriarchal society, men lead and men are the leaders. And if we can get those individuals, the men, in line with what matters, then maybe it will be more likely that this relationship can last. Is that?
Well, I agree, but I think there are just also other aspects to it.
Okay.
I think that's one aspect. So if we're making a sandwich here, you know, we're about to make one of them BLTs, you know, so we're going to add some more layers to it. So for example, I say that patriarchy is intended to oppress women and capitalism is intended to oppress men. Okay. And we know that the two of those are intertwined. This is a wealthy white man's world.
Absolutely.
Right. So it's not that it's right. So it's not that it's a man's world. It's a wealthy white man's world.
Yes.
That's why we have the likes of certain leaders in our country who can seem to just kind of do whatever they want to do. And somehow, no matter how egregious against our morals and our values it appears as if life just continues on for certain groups of people.
Right. Because when you are wealthy, you don't have to have values and morals.
Right. It's replaced by capital. So So again, the thing that's placed in front as more important, even when you don't have capital, is still capital, because there is this idea of the American dream. And so you're supposed to be aiming for that.
Absolutely.
And almost by any means necessary.
Which is even at the sacrifice or the expense of your relationship sometimes.
Absolutely. Even if it's illegal, it's okay for it to be illegal. The name of the game when it's illegal is don't get caught.
Exactly.
If you don't get caught, more right. power to you. If you get caught, then you got caught.
Yeah.
So we have a system that is actually designed to oppress men in the same way it's designed to oppress women.
Right.
Patriarchally, we say, well, the value system of men, by definition of being man, makes a man superior to women. That's what patriarchy does. Capitalism says, you have the have and the have nots. And if you have not, then you can't play in this game.
Right.
So you end up having people who are either, if you're not male, white male, and then if you're not off a certain wealth, everybody's falls below that line. So at that point, you realize that men are extremely oppressed by the notion of provide and protect.
Yes.
Yeah. They are overwhelmed. They crumble under that notion because, again, the value system placed around it is very misleading. And then that same notion of provide and protect and security for women becomes the same side of that two-edged sword that's also used in order to oppress men and also keep women subjugated. So it's literally a system set up to keep the have-nots, if you will, fighting amongst themselves, mm-hmm. while the rich upper class people
continue to
capitalize mm-hmm. on the conflict that's happening below them economically.
Right, and I'm looking at that, and to me, so that makes a lot of sense, and especially when you pull out the and you're looking at race, right? When you pull out race and you say, as African Americans who have been marginalized, who have been put in a position, especially African American men, in terms of jobs and things like that, and in the same thing with women. But let's take it a step further. So as a Black woman who is financially stable, if you will, and I can sustain a family on my own or with the assistance of someone else. And so if we have that coming in, why is that pressure not, you know, and you can help me to understand that, but why is that pressure not lifted if say your partner is bringing in something that will help or that can sustain? I know that from a societal standpoint, there's this pressure to be a protector and provider. But if me and you, right, on a personal level are saying, hey, let's do this, you know, together, and it doesn't matter where the income is coming from, as long as there's income there that supports our needs, why is that not valued in the same way as it is, you know, for you as a man to protect and provide for me? You get what I do.
What I hear you saying is if the end goal is to be able to have certain capital to support your life, for Black men and Black women, what difference should it make if it comes from the woman? Why not see that as a plus or a positive to be able to build together? I think a couple of things are happening all at once. Again, the identity of men in this patriarchal westernized society and in other religious societies as well, have this notion that in order for me to be a man, I have to be able to be the economic breadwinner, mm-hmm. and I have to be this provider in of resources in that way. And men, one of the reasons why I wrote the book is because men, I believe, in the 21st century are challenged because they have a very shifting and changing role.
Okay.
And so we have that is the result of having a new woman, a new Black woman. Mm-hmm. In the 21st century, we have a much more progressive, well-to-do, upward mobile Black woman. Mm-hmm. So a lot of times when we are having a conversation, when we look at it from a conflict resolution standpoint, we're either having a conversation about need or a conversation about value. At one point, the conversation with Black men used to be about need. Mm-hmm. But that need isn't the same way anymore.
Right.
Right. So now the conversation has shifted to a conversation about value.
Right.
Follow me now. The Black man does not have a history of a conversation about value. That's not his socialization. His socialization is one of being able to fulfill a need.
Yes.
Now that the need is removed in its historical traditional way, mm-hmm. the conversation has shifted. And now you want me to talk about being an effective communicator, showing my emotions. You want me to be self-actualized. You want me to be able to tap into my feminine energy and all that. Now all of a sudden, whoa, that's not what I was taught.
Right.
So we have this social deconstruction and reconstruction of the man that's happening. It's called a paradigm shift. And we are in the middle of experiencing it as we are metamorphized.
Right. And so that because of that shift, there's a lot of times that conflict is internal and you don't even know it until
absolutely
something butts up against it.
Right.
And then that's when you realize it's a value conflict and not a need conflict. And right. It feels like a disrespect issue, and it's not. You know, all
right,
the
because
time.
The identity of the man historically has been filtered through those lenses of need.
Right. But I think that's important, and I'm glad that you brought that you know, I think we say it differently, but the way in which you explained it makes a lot of sense, is that because you hear this argument, and I know you've seen it on social media all the time, you know, about the independent Black woman and, you know, I don't need a man, but, you know, such and such and such. So to hear it explained in that way, hopefully helps others to see that this isn't about, I don't need you in the aspect of, you know, in a disrespectful way, is that no, we can sustain on our own. But what I want is I desire you to be a part of this empire, this kingdom, right? And the only way I can do that is if we share values.
And I think what's happening simultaneously is not only are men adjusting to the shifting role and the development of women, I think women are also shifting, are also learning how to shift and how to properly procure and administer this newly found power, because we all have different currencies, whether emotional, beauty's a currency,
right?
You know, money's a currency, skill sets are currencies. So I think women, especially Black women, in their newfound currency of upward mobility, are also learning how to manage the scale because it's newfound power. And I think I look at Black women in general like I do with Black people overall when I talk about economics. Like Black people as a group, it's not used to money, mm-hmm. right? You know, our money stays within our community for 6 hours,
right?
So Black people get money, and having money becomes a matter of now demonstrating, showing you have money. It's flashy. It's we go through that process. I think Black people with money are like 12-year-olds, right? You know, like white people are like a 50-year-old man who's used to having money. Like it works differently for them. I think Black women, similarly, in a parallel fashion, are like 12-year-olds with this newly found power of money and freedom and empowerment and hear me roar and I can whop and pop and lock and bop, bop, bop. So they're learning how to also mature with how to manage, balance, and lead in their capacity with that newly found power.
Right. I see it. I think that there's always, you know, you always have outliers, but I think there's a group of women that have always been able to understand and appreciate that currency that they have and not abuse it. You know what I'm saying? That welcomes, you know, as long as you're an equal, because equal partner doesn't mean that we have to bring in everything equally. You know what I'm saying?
Right. And I think that's a matter of equity, right? Where people in learning how to be equitable in relationships is really what I think people mean when they're saying equal, right? It's not, I mean, I think the other part of relationships, though, that people severely miss is oneness. And especially when we talk about money, all of a sudden when we get to the money, there's this point of departure for people, right? I'm of the persuasion, especially as a Christian man, that money, if we really want to take it all belongs to the Lord.
Right.
We're asked to be good stewards of it.
Right.
Okay. Because it ain't nothing for either one of us to get touched in that $100,000 job or that six-figure job and situations turn around. And I don't even necessarily need to go to the extreme of a victimized situation in order to drive the person home. Mm-hmm. Right. But if it's all one pot.
Yes.
Right. And I do think women in the feedback that I hear and my experiences, they are struggling with this idea of oneness, because when it was the other way around, it was easy. If the man made $10 and she made $3, oh yeah, we got $13. It's 13 now.
Now, hold on now. Now I agree with you, but I think what, you're stupid.
I know. Now she made 10 and he made 3 and she's like, wait a minute now.
So I think then the struggle is not so much that about the need, it's about still we have in our mind value. And society is still telling us all day that in order for you to be a man, you need to protect and provide. And so mm-hmm. even though on a conscious level, right, I'm saying to you, I'm good, we good, you know, what I have or what we share should be enough. But subconsciously, because society has told me, I ain't no man. If you gotta pull out,
you making ten and I'm making three, I'm not the man. Right.
Right. Right. And even though on a emotional level, I'm saying it's okay, but you know, when we talk about, because people are really influenced by how perception, right? So how others perceive us, you know, where, and I tell people all the time, you got to get people out of your ear, out of your relationship. So, you know, oh, you had to pull out, you know, your check. You had to pull out your wallet and pay for dinner. Never me.
Yeah, it's all perception, right? And we have centuries of this entrenchment in how we've come to here. I remember someone told me before that she and her husband will go out to eat, and they don't do it as much now, but the waiter or waitress will give the check to the man, right? This idea that he has to pay. Or even if they give it to her, even if she takes it, it's almost like, oh, you're paying. And she was like, she doesn't say anything, but their merit is coming from the same account. But the visual of the man doing something is how we've been socialized. One of the things I talk about in my book is that people's practice does not meet their value system.
Absolutely.
They practice different. I was in the grocery store and I wrote this anecdote in my book. True story. I'm in the grocery store. There's a lady in front of me, and my groceries move down the conveyor belt next to hers. And so I joke and I say, well, you could just go ahead and pay for everything. Right. And the cashier said, oh no, you're the man, you're supposed to pay. Little did she know who she was talking to when she said that. Right. So I was like, so I said to her, why do I have to pay? I said, you know, she could pay. I said, what if she makes more money than me? She was like, it doesn't matter. You're the man. So I said, so even if she makes like $100,000 a year and I only make like 20, like I'm supposed to still pay? She was like, yeah. I said, okay. So interestingly enough, though, the lady never said anything. She smiled, she looked, she smirked, she got her stuff and she went on about her business. And when it was my turn to say, come up to the cashier, I said to her, I was like, you know, it don't really work like that, right, in real life. And you know what she said to me? She says, oh, I know. My boyfriend and I, we contribute to everything. And I'm saying to her, so how are you going to tell me what everything you were just saying a few minutes ago when you practice an entire different way of life? Mm-hmm. So people are trapped into always aspiring toward the conflict or the dissonance or difference between this upper white male, high class, wealthy society as still seeing that as the epitome of what success is. Right. And even though they're in the have nots in terms of the disparity in money and life and lifestyle, they're still trying to get here and will do everything in their consciousness to still appeal to that, even though their lifestyle is the very opposite of it.
Right. Right. Because that's the ideal. So, you know, that's that happens in relationships. And that's where sometimes conflict also comes in, right? Because I'm looking at my girlfriend's relationship or my parents' relationship, and I'm comparing it to what me and my partner have. Mm-hmm. And
it's not going to work.
It's not. You know,
oneness is one. If people can understand the importance of oneness being oneness, I mean, I like the energy in the conversation of, hey, whether you're male or female, it shouldn't matter what the money is, especially in 2021.
Right.
Where women have all the access that they have in what they have. Mm-hmm. And it's not that so many more women are making money, but a lot of Black women are making good money.
Right.
And the part of the system that I really dislike the most, which I think is a disservice to everybody, is we have these conflicting messages. Pursue your passion, walk in your gift, fulfill your purpose.
Right.
But everybody's passion, gift, and purpose doesn't equal to the same level of money. And I think that is so unfair to people, especially men, in the sense that if his passion or purpose only makes him $55,000 a year, but he works at that program and he's with those kids and he's a great role model and figure and he loves children, but that only makes him $55,000 a year, why does that disqualify him?
Right.
Because from a woman who's saying, well, if you don't make $75,000 or better. So unfortunately, I think what people are doing is they are dating their disparity or dating their lack of security more so than they are dating the value system that they need to attach themselves to.
Right.
And then on the flip side, because this is a yo-yoing situation and it is a vie for power between men and women. Mm-hmm. Because on the flip side, the man who now has the capital makes it clearly known that this is my money in the sense that I'm the man and I'm going to run this. And then he makes her role smaller in some instances.
Or he narrows out and it becomes less of a value and it becomes more like what you look like, what you bring, what I want, what, you know, my ideal woman, you know, that trophy type of person. And so I get to make all the rules because I don't, you don't even have to necessarily think. And I don't want you to think.
He doesn't need her. She needs him. So he's still pushing it from a space of need. So when men, in that case, when men have an opportunity to be in a position of being the needed based on their capital, they're going to capitalize on that, right? And overlook a woman's value. And then when women have the need already taken care of, they overlook a man's value.
Yeah.
So it's, but that's where the conflict is in a lot of instances. And that's why I think it's necessary to talk about it so that people can understand what's really going on and hopefully be motivated to say, let me be a more value driven person. Mm-hmm. Who understands the importance of character and connecting with someone who helps me fulfill my passion and my purpose. And that's going to look different with salary.
And it does. And again, I think, you know, I it's interesting, right? So when I was married, me and my ex-husband we had a shared account and then we both had our separate accounts, right? But what we didn't have money issues. Like because it wasn't a big deal. Now, when my mom and dad were married, they had a joint account and it would seem like it was always an argument about who spent the money. You know what I'm saying? Which is interesting, you know, even though they made closer to the same amount of money than me and my ex-husband. So we never argued because what the joint account was what took care of everything that we needed, the needs. The money that was put in our own savings account, our own personal savings account, was for our pleasure. You know what I'm saying? It was for what we desired to get each other or to get ourselves. But as long as we covered the need first, and then we worried about the extras later. And it doesn't matter if you put 70, 40, 30, 30, you know, 50, 50 or whatever into the account, because again, like you said, money comes different. So what it was more like is each of us got the same amount of spend money, if you will, and the rest of our money went into the joint account, you know? And then if I don't spend up all my spend money, I may have, you know, $2,000 or $3,000 to buy something. Where you spend it on video games every week, then you don't have spend money. But that's not money that you go into the joint account to spend to buy a video game. You get what I'm saying? And we never
I definitely get what you're saying.
Yeah, so we never had any financial issues. That wasn't our argument. You know what I'm saying? I do think that a lot of couples have this reservation or hesitation of putting their money together.
Especially when the woman makes more money. Especially when the woman makes more money. She's okay with it when he makes more.
She's definitely okay with it, but I think he's okay with it because he wants to be the, you know, because society says this is what you
need.
Right.
He wants to be in the category of need.
Yeah.
Right. And I don't think there's, so to balance the conversation, the reality is people make all different ranges of money.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And so the money itself is not the issue, but it's how we identify with the money, our relationship with the money, and then how we use the money as a tool.
Yes.
If someone is using the money as a tool, as a controlling mechanism, right, then that's mismanagement. Right. And then if someone is not being considered because of the money, right? Now, I understand what we're saying to a certain extent that, well, you know what, if you've done everything you're supposed to do, air quotes, mm-hmm. in this pathway that's been set up. There is a pathway in America that there is the, you go to school, you finish, then you go to college or to trade school, and then you get a job, and then, you know, you gain some professional experience, and then between 26, 27, 28, 29, 30, 31, 32, you get married, then you start having children. You should have bought a house in between that time. You should work at this particular job or industry for a good 25 to 30 years, and then you're able to retire, you're contributing to your Social Security, and that's supposed to repeat itself. Rinse, watch, repeat type of thing. Well, the reality is that's not a lot of people's reality.
Right.
And again, like I said, when people have a different aspirations or they want a job change or they're inspired to do something else, or there is this idea that I want to pursue something, then all of that gets very mixed up. So you could have a person at a particular age or point in life whose life doesn't look as standard as one would want it to be. People can overcome that, though, if you're dealing with an individual who's grounded, emotionally available, emotionally intelligent, who understands what it is to work through conflict, right? See, those skill sets are the most important ones that needs to be in place, because when you have a person like that, then you have a person who's most likely ambitious and industrious. Mm-hmm. So it's not that they cannot make money or they've plateaued, but you're also dealing with a person who has plans and visions and is working towards something, right, at different junctures. And you could be you could make $1 million and still have plans and things that you want to work towards. So the money in and of itself is not the testament to it. It's the character of the person and understanding their vision and their plan.
Yeah. And I think, but that goes back to what I'm saying. A lot of times we don't spend enough time getting to know each other, asking the hard questions, trying to figure out where your values lie. And not the old question of, you know, where do you see yourself in 5 years? Not necessarily that, but really looking at what is it that motivates you? What drives you? Where does your passion, motivation come from? And we don't ask those kind of questions when we're dating. You know what I'm saying? And then when we get into a situation with children or a house or things that are tied together, now I'm looking at you and I'm like, you know, where's your passion? Where's your motivation? You know, and we're arguing about things that we shouldn't necessarily even be arguing about, because that's what I was going to ask you. Typically, are we arguing about things that are there, or are we arguing about something that's usually, you know, are we arguing about what we're actually arguing about, or is it something else there?
I think in a lot of instances, people are arguing about failed expectations coupled with there's a word I'm looking for, but it deals with a disrespect of their identity. Their failed expectations and or a disrespect of their identity. See, if a person says that they see themselves a certain way, and then you do something to impact how I see myself, mm-hmm. right, then that's an argument. And to project it out, if there's an expectation that I have of you, which should also be based on how I see myself and how I see the other person, then that leads to some level of conflict or disagreement. So a lot of times the argument or the first conversation that a person needs to be with themselves about why they feel the way they do, what's motivating them, what are they trying to get to as an end result, and work that conversation out with themselves before they can address it with another person.
So I agree. And I used to say that with my clients when I used to see clients on a regular basis. It's like, first, take a moment. And figure out where the conversation turned left before you engage. You know what I'm saying? Because if you can figure out what was said or what was done to make you feel a certain way, that then shift. Because once you shift, I'm going to shift.
Right. And I think a good question to also ask yourself is, who told me that I'm entitled to that?
Right. I did. Because of my currency, because I'm making the most money, or I'm the prettiest woman you ever dated, or whatever, because of my currency. So I told myself that I'm entitled to that, you know, and that's, and you're right. It does boil down to how I see myself or what I feel I'm entitled to. But expectations is a big thing, or unmet or unspoken expectations. There's this thing that I talk about where I call anticipate. Huh?
I said those unspoken ones, man, those.
Well, but even worse than unspoken is what I call it anticipated. Because you know me so well, you should know that this is how I want it to be done. Or you should kind of think, you know, like there's an anticipated expectation that people never talk about that. But there's this anticipatory expectation. You know I like things done this way, this way, this way. So why would you come in and do it something else? You know.
Right.
I shouldn't have to tell you because you've been living with me. So you, if you know me, you would know that I would choose this instead of that. I've never said it. I haven't even thought about it as an unspoken expectation. It's just because I anticipate knowing you, or you knowing me, that this is what you should do, or this is how you should choose. And I think that if we don't, but a lot of people don't know how to verbalize that. So I agree. Like, where is this coming from? And you first have to look at, is this a me issue or is this a real issue?
Very, very well said. I totally agree. And in most instances, it's a me issue, right? most, if not all conflict is first internal, right? That internal conflict needs to be resolved before the external one can be resolved.
Yeah. But what would you say, or how would you suggest? Because I think, you know, I'm not a man, never been a man, but my experience and professionally and personally is that ego gets in the way a lot of times. And not that pride isn't a big thing for women, but for men, like they will, I mean, will stand in that because it's a impact on their pride or their ego. So how does one, whether it's male or female, how does one begin the process of looking at self before, you know, saying, okay, now I can address the issue? Because a lot of times, once I've already opened my mouth and said what I said, it's hard to take that back.
Yeah, it is. I think the best way, I think one's approach to consider is to first and foremost ask, what do you want the result of this to be? Okay. And second, keep in mind how much do you value the relationship? And if you can determine, if you can say, I value the relationship highly, that's good. And then determine, I want the outcome to be this. Once you wrapped around that, I think that's a good starting point to approach yourself and to approach the other person. Now, I know what it feels like to quote unquote know you're right about something, mm-hmm. and to feel that it's being overlooked. I know what it's like to know that you're right about something and the other person think they're right about something, but they're still wrong about, or they're missing parts of it. And you're still trying to figure out how do I maneuver through this? The third thing that I've learned is do away with the need to be right.
Yes.
If you can do away with the need to be right. And I write about that in my book. I was challenged with that. You know, I was like, cause I know I'm right about what I'm saying, but I valued being right more than I valued the relationship, right? Mm-hmm. Even though I thought I valued, and so, but I mean, if you put it numerically, even if you say, oh yeah, I value the relationship highly. Okay, put a number to it. I value out of 9 out of 10. Oh, I value the relationship out of 10. Well, you value being right at an 11.
Yes.
Right?
Yes.
So if you value being right more so than the relationship, then, you know. The fourth thing that works well, though, to combat the issue of right and wrong, or you know, when you know that you're right about something, and that's fine to be right and know that you're making good sense, because sometimes a person can't see it. And that's where number four comes in. Time. I love time. Mm-hmm. Time heals all wounds. Time clears things up. Time is beautiful. Time works in a way that it allows itself, it allows things to work out to prove if you were right, if you were right. And it, time allows situation to, you know, it could be important a day during this conversation, and a month from now, it ain't that important.
It's not.
You know, with whatever it is that we'll, that we, that you all were talking about or having the confrontation about, it could just wither.
Yeah.
Which is good, but time allows for that to happen.
Yeah.
So bank on time.
Yeah. One of the things when I taught anger management, I would tell them is to stand in your rightness. So the moment you get out of that box, right, trying to prove that you're right, that's when you become wrong. So that's where that going, where you value being right more than your relationship, because then you're going to shame the person or make belittle the person, whatever it is that you're doing to prove that you're right. So if you stand in your rightness, time, and that's what I tell them, time will show that you're right. You don't have to do anything. Just stand there, stand in being right. That's enough. Because the moment you step out of that box of rightness, you're wrong. And I can get you for it all day.
I love what you're saying. I love what you're saying. Yeah. Yeah. I love that. Oh man, that's really good. If you don't mind,
you can have it. It's all you.
Thank you. That's
you
beautiful.
Can use it more than
I love that. That's so clear. The moment you step out of that right position, right? So, because what I hear you saying is there's a rightness in maybe the technicality of the conversation, but then there's also this rightness of attitude and rightness of disposition, right? So yeah. If the rightness of your attitude is right about what you believe that you're right about, stay in the space of having the right attitude. Because in the right attitude, you can be empathetic, you can be compassionate, you can communicate effectively, you can forgive, you can be patient, you can forget, which is good, which is the best thing to do. Ah, let's just forget about it. You're more given. You're freer in that space, flexible. That's the word I want. You're more flexible. So the moment you step out of that right attitude, mm-hmm. and because of your technically being right, now you've stepped out into wrong. Now you're going to do anything in order to prove that you were right, but you have the wrong attitude.
Yeah. Because I have this example. One of my friends, it was him and his wife. They was having an argument about Listerine, right? Whether you should use Listerine before you floss, before or after, you know, whatever with the Listerine, you know, which one is more effective. Do you know, to prove how right he was, he called up the number on the back of the Listerine. So mm-hmm. now you see, because what you did is shamed me. What you did is told me that I'm not intelligent. So you know what I'm saying? There's so much wrong in your rightness, in your journey to prove that you're right. There's so much wrong that occurs. And so it's important to just stand in your rightness. You do it a month or the next 6 months, you do it your way, I'll do it my way, and we'll see who has cavities. You know, whatever. But when you go and to the extent of any means necessary to prove that I'm right, you do a whole lot of wrong.
You do a whole lot of wrong. You do a whole lot of wrong trying to prove you right. That's so true. I like that. I like that. That is so true.
So what I wanted to ask you, and I know I didn't preempt it, but what is a hostile negotiation when we're talking about a relationship? What do you think I'm just throwing that at you. What would be an example of a hostile negotiation?
I think the worst part, one of the worst parts of having conversations that are centered around a disagreement is using ultimatums, right? And so when you talk about hostile negotiation, first thing that came to me was those ultimatums.
Yes.
When part of the conversation becomes, if you don't do this, then this is what will happen. Or you need to choose between X and Y. So the moment you put options on the table, not options, you know, in terms of, hey, this is solution A or solution B and solution C, you know, which let's talk about each of these options and see which one works best for us, right? Even if you'd be like, I don't really like C, but I hear you, but let's talk about it. That's fine, you know. But the moment you become, if you don't do A, then I'm no longer going to dot, 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 right? Then that makes for a very hostile type of communication, negotiation. I do encourage people, though, to not negotiate, to not compromise, but to collaborate.
Okay.
And there is a difference between the three, and I know you know that. You know, negotiations, you usually speak to two parties that are at odds, not even on the same team. So consider that, right? Mm-hmm. Negotiations are between parties who are not on the same team. Mm-hmm. Compromise can happen between two parties that are not on the same team or two parties that are on the same team. But compromise usually leaves both parties with a short end of the stick.
Yes.
When you collaborate, collaboration is looking for what I call the triple win. You want to win, they win, and the community wins.
Right.
Right? And when you collaborate, it gives you more flexibility to come up with more with solutions. And a lot of times collaboration means a long-term solution, longer than just compromising, right? Compromising gives you the right now immediate satisfaction. But a collaboration, for example, you know, if you wanted to go to the store and you want to get a new outfit, or you want to go to the store, but you don't say that you want to get a new outfit. But I need to go drop the children this way. And there is a situation with the car. But you insist on going to the store and you'll be back. And I'm saying, but the kids have this thing. They need to be there on time. But you are like, listen, I gotta go. Then I become annoyed, like, okay, this is not making sense to me. You know, the children do X, Y, and Z every, you know, on this day at a particular time. We're down to one car. What's so important about the store? But if we have a conversation and put everything on the table, mm-hmm. right? You have to be able to put everything on the table. It's simple. Listen, what you hiding for? Forget about the, I shouldn't have to tell you what I'm going to the store for. Like, I'm not trying to babysit you. I'm trying to find the best approach here. Now, it may be, hey, I'm going to the store because I want to get a dress. Okay, what you getting a dress for? Well, this event is coming up and I want to look good for it. Okay. Well, so maybe there's some alternatives. Is there a specific store that you want to go to? Can we, is online available? Will the store be open tomorrow? But maybe the way the situation gets resolved is I'll drop the kids tonight so they could get there on time. And tomorrow I'll only work half a day, come home so you can get the car and go shopping. And then .. You may say, well, there's a sale tonight, you know? Okay. And then we may decide that, well, what the children are doing, you know, is not as important as trying to get to the sale because this is something that you've been trying to get with. The kids are just going to have to miss it. Well, now, you know, the kids are not going to like it.
Right.
So who's going to explain to the kids why they can't go? Right. And so maybe we got to talk about that together. So maybe we decide, well, why don't we take the kids to the store and we also get them something to cover for tonight. And you also get your new dress. You see what I'm saying? Like,
right.
There has to be it gives us a win-win-win.
Right. Right. And the thing is, or, you know, what it does is it makes up more possibilities. But when I only talk about what I need and want in order to feel like this is okay, and you only talk about what you need and want, and we're not collaborating and we're holding things back, right? Because I don't want you to know how much money I'm gonna spend on the dress. That's why I don't want you to come with me, you know, whatever the case might be. So there's and to me, that speaks to sometimes that vulnerability that I think lacks a lot of times in relationships, that people have a you know, this difficult time with being vulnerable with their partner to be able to share with you my whole self, meaning being 100% honest with you all the time. And I think that if people are, well, let me back that up. Some things you do have to keep, I guess, to yourself, if you will, but for the most part, being honest about what's going on in that moment so that I can make a well thought out decision.
A most informed decision. Absolutely.
Yeah. But if you're holding back what, you know, some key information, then I'm going to fall back on what I need versus what could work for, you know, everybody involved, you know. Mm-hmm. So I definitely agree collaboration is the way to go. I guess my question to you too was, what does conflict or conflict resolution tell us in a relationship? What is it, you know, does it, is it, you know, because again, all couples argue. We know that. We know that all couples argue or have conflict. So what does, you know, is it, is conflict a good thing or is it always a bad thing? What are you, what are your thoughts?
No, beautiful question. Because most of the times when we talk about conflict, we associate it with it being something bad. Conflict is really just an opportunity, right? It's an opportunity. Another conflict resolution expert puts it, these two ladies talk about conflict being an energy, right? And so it gives us an opportunity to do something with that energy. Because we don't, a lot of times, we don't know that there is a gap in the system or a lapse in the system until we run into that interference.
Right.
So the conflict that comes up shows us, oh, okay, this is a hole that needs to be plugged, right? So now, going back to the simple example of you trying to get a dress and the sale and what that may look like, that may open up a pathway to, maybe we need to set aside some funds for you to change up your wardrobe, right? So the conflict there that initiated from trying to these incompatible goals and needs of the children versus you and your identity and wanting to look beautiful and what that means to you could lead to, hey, babe, look, every month we're now going to do this. And in a couple months, you know, take all of this and I'm going to give you this to redo your wardrobe. This way you won't ever have, this way you could get stuff and you always have this money set aside. You know, it just gives us opportunity. The question is, what do we do with that opportunity when conflict arises? And that's where it demonstrates one's emotional maturity. How you manage the conflict reflects your emotional maturity.
Right.
So that's what conflict does for us. And that becomes very telling.
Yeah. Because for me, and I tell people all the time, like, conflict or arguments are good because it shows you the limits. It gives you the boundaries. It lets you know, you know, and it gives you information, just like anger. You know, it lets you know, it gives you information, and with information you can make better decisions. Before that, you're making a decision based off of not all of the information. And so now we have all the information, or at least we have more of the information.
More information, for sure.
And, right. And we can begin to collect even more, because, you know, when conflict hits, I'm going to ask you some more questions. Like, you know, why have you never said anything to me about this before? Why is this just now coming up? You know, I didn't even know you had an event. So much more information comes up,
right.
You know,
right.
As a result.
And maybe out of that, we come up with a plan. Hey, you know, baby, let me know when you have events, or is there any way we could plan? Like, the thing too, to keep in mind is, this is not about perfection.
It's not.
This is about, in fact, it's about making room and having grace for our imperfections.
Absolutely. And I think that most people want to, you know, they don't know, we live in the gray, but they want to be on the black or white. They want to be right or wrong. They want to live in those two. But most of what we do is in gray. And so you have to be flexible. You have to be flexible because, again, when I talk about being prepared, marital preparedness is not about, you know, premarital therapy and things like that. Marital preparedness is about knowing myself, number one, knowing what my limits are, knowing who I am, knowing what I like and dislike, so that when it impacts or it comes into contact with whoever I'm dealing with, I know what, you know, what I'm dealing with. And then you talked about it, emotional intelligence, or, you know, emotional regulation, right? So I know how you normally get, you know, under stress, this is how he operates, boom, 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 you know, so I know how to approach that situation when he's under stress. When he's not under stress, I know we can do this, 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 and this. It's about knowing myself, then knowing my partner, right? And we continue to do that by asking the difficult questions, allowing ourselves to continue to explore each other. But if I think that I know you, and it, well, you're changing, No, it's not changing. We all change. We all evolve. Right. And so we have to continue to evolve. And if you can't evolve, then that relationship, that conflict becomes so much more heavy, if that makes sense.
Oh, absolutely. Because then it creates a breakdown. It's almost like, it reminds me of a car. You know, if, you know, you mess around and mess up one thing, then it's going to impact another part of the car, and then this gets jammed up, and then that gets jammed up, and next thing you know, you got to change out a whole, you know, you got to gut the whole thing. So
you got a whole new car, a whole new woman.
Yeah, think about water damage in the home, right? Right. You know, right. It can start from the tub and fill up, but then when that water hits over the tub and then it starts to hit the wood and then it's run downstairs, and if you live in a property where someone's below you, oh my God! So it's relationships require maintenance and management.
Yes.
Right. And conflict resolution skills is the maintenance service provider for doing that.
Absolutely. I like that because, you know, people so much focus on communication, right? But it's not so much whether we communicate effectively, and I know that that's all part of that, but it's how you resolve conflict. It's how we come back from what our issues are that makes a difference. It's how we are resilient in right. our problem solving, you know, how flexible we can be without, you know, bending without breaking, whatever, however you want to look at it. That is a telltale sign of how long we last. If we're going to do everything to make it last, or everything.
Exactly.
You know right. what I'm saying?
So you either get married and do everything except make it last, or you could get married and make it last.
And that's it. You know, if we are able to, you know, when you're bending, I'm stretching. You know what I'm saying? So we have to be able to work together, you know, and grow together. It's when we start having our own and we begin to pull apart because, you know, my passion, you know, when you were talking about your passion and your gift and your talent and things like that, that's pulling me away, or you don't understand that and I'm not allowing you to be a part of that, or I don't want to be a part of that, then we begin to grow apart because it doesn't feed the family, right? And so I don't see why you spend so much time mentoring these kids when we got kids. Mentor them, you know, whatever right. the case may be. I don't see the value in what you're doing. And we begin to pull apart.
That sounded too real right there. Mentor our kids. I don't see how that's feeding the family. That's some things that get said, though, but that's that real. But it goes back to what do we value versus where do we put emphasis on our value system or on our need system?
Right. Right. And the thing about a need, yes, there are some things, you know, when we talk about the hierarchy of needs, there are some things that we have to have, you know, right. in order to survive. But then there's just these needs that are just really strong wants. And so sometimes over time.
And entitlements.
Yeah. Sometimes over time, they become less and less of a need and more of a want, or not even a thing anymore. Right. It feeds into those insecurities that we ourselves may or may not understand. But this is what I need in order to feel secure. So you have to provide that. You have to give me that, whatever that is, male or female. You know what
Absolutely.
I'm saying?
Right.
And so what happens is that in turn, when you can't meet my needs, I no longer need you. And we have conflict, or we end up getting a divorce, or whatever the case may be. So I want to, I mean, because to me, I could talk to you or talk about this all day long, and I don't want to use up all of your time. So I appreciate you spending this hour with me and talking to us about conflict and in a way that's different, because you talked about it in the whole global sense, not just in the relationship, which I think, but when we bring it back, it still makes sense inside of the
right,
relationship. Yeah, and it is. It really is connected because one of the things that we don't do in Black families a lot of times is build wealth. And so what we're trying to do here is build wealth within our home, in our relationships. And this is how you can do that. You know, you build wealth through value, not through monetary means.
And I think that's a great point. I like that approach because what I think Black America needs to do is understand the importance of first valuing each other.
Yes.
Right. When we value each other, which includes beginning with our family nucleus, then it sets the foundation for us to now put our resources toward economic growth.
Yes.
But you can't get to that when the family nucleus is dissolved and our value system amongst each other is as it is what it currently, you know, is in a lot of ways.
Distrust. It is very, you know, very distrusting, unfortunately.
Very distrusting, absolutely. It's very distrusting and disrespectful.
Yes.
And we'll be better off. So it's my hope that in these conversations, that when people hear it, it's able to provide them a little bit clearer lens to see our opportunities for working together through.
Yeah.
And when the more we are more effective, we're able to do that, then the more successful we'll be in building family businesses, mm-hmm. in creating legacies, in filtering our money through our own communities. But it's very hard to get to that if the relationship one-on-one, that internal conflict and that relationship conflict is not first resolved.
Or managed, at least. I agree with you so much, because what I'm hearing you say is basically, if I can't spend my dollars in my community or keep my dollars in my community, right? If I don't see the values reflected, right? And so, because we can't keep our own nucleus family together, whatever that means.
Right.
So right. that value... You don't have the same values, even if I don't live my values, because, you know, our behavior is inconsistent, is consistently inconsistent with our values. Our behavior is.
Mm-hmm.
So even though I'm not living those values, I want to spend my money where I believe the values reflect my values. And so if your values don't reflect mine, Black people, then I'm not spending my money, because the message about Blacks is that we are shysters. That we're trying to manipulate you into buying something you don't need, whatever the case may be.
Don't even provide the same quality of service.
Yes, the quality. Yes. Exactly. And so it's that kind of thing. And so, but that comes from the fact that, but if we had family businesses and we had that same kind of energy in our own homes, our families, if we had that there, and then it would automatically reflect, we would know. You get what I'm saying? I don't know if that's clear, but it's almost like the reason why our community isn't doing so well is because we as a unit aren't doing well. So once we heal this unit, then it'll be reflective in our community and in the larger society. But until we heal this unit, we're not going to be able to keep our dollars within and continue to promote economic wealth amongst the
community. The wealth that we need to first consider is not economic. The wealth that we need to first consider is state of mind, the mental health, our physical wealth. Those things are primary, right? Because you need that clearness of space, of mind, of community in order to build, right?
Right.
Right? You know, in a lot of ways, it's foggy, and you can't, it's hard to build in a fog.
Yes.
Right. You know, you, when the fog clears, by the time you put hammer and nail together, you don't know what you may have come away with and how many nails you may have put in someone else's head. So it's difficult to build in that kind of circumstance.
Yeah, I agree. I like the analogy. And so I think that, you know, this has been a very interesting conversation, because it brings the how connected and interconnected everything is and how important it is it's more than just me and you. It's me and you, because that reflects what our children see,
right.
What the larger society sees. And so
exactly.
How we resolve this conflict is going to be reflected over and over, because my daughter will leave my home and she will engage someone, and so on and so forth. And even in a intimate relationship, as well as a social relationship, how we resolve conflict is reflective of that first unit, you know, our first experience, our family. And so if we start doing that differently, and more efficiently, then we have no other choice. I mean, society will, you know, will respond. Our communities will begin to respond the more often we do it appropriately. So I thank you. I know, like I said, I enjoy having authentic, genuine conversations. So I appreciate you coming on and talking to us about conflict and negotiations and actually you like collaboration. And I think that that's important because you do, you get more options. You get more choices when you collaborate versus, because with compromise, one of the things I talk about with compromise, if we're going to compromise, somebody's going to lose.
Absolutely.
Somebody's going to lose. And so you have to be willing. And that's okay if that's the agreement, if that's the understanding. But I may lose this time, but you have to be willing to lose the next time when it's really important to me. And if you have a partner that never wants to be on the losing end of the compromise, you're going to have a lot of conflict.
You're going to have a lot of conflict. Yep. Definitely going to have some more challenges for sure.
So any final thoughts or any nuggets of wisdom that you can give anyone when they're thinking about conflict resolution or how to approach that situation differently?
I think for couples, remember that oneness is oneness. I think that's important for people to aspire toward that in every aspect of their life, not create points of departure because it's convenient or suitable or advantageous to one party. And when it comes to conflict resolution, you know, I think it's just always important to remember that the first level of conflict is internal. And we are constantly in a space of resolving our identity and renegotiating our own identity and understanding who we are and making a decision to grow, evolve, and to be consistent in our maturation in a world that is constantly giving us more information and images and structures about what is right or wrong, mm-hmm. right? And that's why people become so confused. So, you know, do the necessary study to show thyself approved, you know, tap into information and the content that you know is wholesome and hold on to that. And that's going to help settle the spirit and the identity of the individual. So when they are confronted with situations, they have a firmer grasp of how to approach it because they have a firmer grasp of who they are.
Right. Again, tell us the book title and where they can find it. And also I want to invite you back. And that's when you have time, but this idea of oneness and equally yoked and all of that stuff. If you're interested in coming back.
I absolutely am. I would definitely love to come back. I appreciate it. Again, the name of the book is Let's Get Married and Do Everything Except Make It Last. You are able to get it everywhere books are sold, including Amazon, Barnes & Noble, Books A Million. Please leave a review on Amazon and on Goodreads.com. Also, you can check out my website, which is www.adriancarterspeaks.com. You can also check out my social media, which is at Adrian Carter Speaks.
Awesome. Well, I appreciate it. Thank you so much. I enjoyed the conversation thoroughly. Made me think a lot about how I see conflict as well. So especially when it comes to emotional intelligence, I think that you may be a good talker or communicator, but when you're not emotionally in a right place, that it can definitely impact the outcome. And so
emotional maturity.
Yeah, emotional I think that's maturity. Really important. And so thank you. And
thank you again.
Hey, that's it for today's episode. Thank you for spending your time with me and keeping me company. If you have a topic you would like to suggest, please email me at stormcommunications2019@gmail.com. If you enjoyed the conversation, please share with your friends and leave me a review on Apple Podcasts, Podchasers, or on my website. And remember, always speak your truth.